This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at station WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and in today's program, the aftermath of the Obama speech on Afghanistan. Yesterday evening, President Barack Obama announced a small reduction in troops over the next year or 18 months. We'll analyze that today with the author of War is a Lie, David Swanson. Also today, we'll hear some of President Obama's own claims in regard to the war in Afghanistan on this eve of a congressional vote about funding and empowering his unilateral military action in Libya. We'll also have the latest developments in the nuclear world today. Stay tuned for this edition of 5 o'clock shadow. We are located here at WBAI at 120 Wall Street in Lower Manhattan, New York City. And even as we speak, there are preparations for the imminent arrival of President Barack Obama. He will have flown in from Fort Drum, where just a short time ago he gave a speech to troops that would be sent to Afghanistan and would continue there at least until the year 2014. Just a short time ago, President Obama praised the soldiers and their work, saying, "You guys have been there in the toughest fights. Because of what you've done, areas like Kandahar, Afghanistan, are more secure than they have been in years. Because of you, we are now taking the fight to the Taliban instead of the Taliban bringing the fight to us." Obama said, "Because of you, there are signs that the Taliban may be interested in figuring out a political settlement, which ultimately is going to be critical for consolidating that country." So the main message the president said that he had is that the American people understand the sacrifices you're making. They understand the sacrifices your families are making, but our job is not finished. Well, we will see just how close to completion that job is. President Obama is imminently arriving in New York City for some fundraising, not for the trillion-dollar cost of the war in Afghanistan, but for the political campaign that might be enhanced by his announcement that there will be another withdrawal of troops just before the 2012 election. To help us decode these events and the speech of the president to the nation last night, we are now joined live by David Swanson. He is the author of The War is a Lie. David, what do you make of the president's retracing his steps as he did at West Point in December 2010 and now once again taking a military tour while trying to reduce the increase of troops that he has initiated?
Well, I don't think he quite managed to get back to December 2010 when he promised and has promised repeatedly since then a significant and substantial withdrawal this July. He announced yesterday 10,000 troops to come out in the next 6 months out of 200,000 personnel in Afghanistan, and then another 23,000 to come out by next September. Which does get us back to December 2010 in terms of U.S. troop levels if you don't pay much attention to contractors. But Obama was president in 2009 as well. This is what the New York Times and everyone else is avoiding, and the president is avoiding. He didn't put in 33,000 troops. He put in 70,000 troops plus contractors. He's been president for 2 years, and he did not make an argument for continuing this war at all. Much less up through 2014, and he did not commit to being done in 2014. He didn't say everybody's out by then. He very carefully said Afghanistan then becomes responsible, presumably as gracious hosts for an ongoing but decreased occupation.
That occupation, could it also conceivably include permanent United States military bases, or perhaps they'll call them training facilities, in the interest of maintaining oil pipelines or other strategic interests there?
Oh, I think they'll be enduring, not permanent. We must be careful how we describe these things. Yes, of course, that has been the goal from the start, including NATO's goal, including the desire to have weapons. Nuclear weapons, missile defense weapons in Afghanistan. The natural gas pipeline to run through Afghanistan has been on Obama's and Karzai's and the Pentagon's list of to-do items for this decade and more. That's clearly part of the ongoing agenda, as is the profitability for certain people and companies of this whole endless operation.
There is something that struck me about the statement that President Obama made overnight, and in particular, some of his words today at Fort Drum. It struck me as odd. He said, because of you troops, there are signs that the Taliban may be interested in figuring out a political settlement. It's my understanding that the Taliban is pretty much always, or that tribal or cultural structure has always been a part of Afghanistan, that the organized part of the Taliban was set up with the assistance of the CIA and the Pakistani ISI intelligence services, but that the local villages have their own methodologies. And did that statement sound odd to you? About his making a breakthrough through military force, that the Taliban would be negotiable?
Yeah, it doesn't fit with the facts. Neither does the earlier clip about the Taliban bringing the fight to us. When did the Taliban ever bring the fight to us? You know, we brought the fight to the Soviet Union. Presumably that was a reference to Al-Qaeda having been in Afghanistan, not to mention Germany and Spain and Maryland. But that's nonsense. Al-Qaeda is not in Afghanistan. The Taliban is in Afghanistan, and we are its number one provider of weapons and of money. We pay the Taliban bribes to drive down highways. A third of the weapons that the United States tries to ship into Afghanistan end up in Taliban hands in Afghanistan or Pakistan. It is a hopelessly corrupt operation. Violence and death and troop deaths and civilian deaths and Taliban strength are all up, right? All of the indicators are negative from this year and a half surge. And that doesn't seem to matter. Things could be succeeding or failing. Either way, the mission must be continued and just decreased in a token amount to satisfy the demand of the U.S. public, a majority of which, by the way, wants the whole thing ended.
There's an issue there with regard to the government that has been installed under the perception of elections in Kabul. Hamid Karzai and his family are repeatedly alleged to be profiteers from the resurgent poppy heroin trade, that of which most of it goes to Europe and England and thereabouts. And that government, that United States supported regime, is receiving money from both ends, from United States foreign aid. There's quite a bit of largesse to the private contractors, the non-uniformed military personnel in Afghanistan. Can you help us understand how the money is flowing? What are the major trends or staging points for the financial takeover of Afghanistan, and where we go from that? We're looking at a $1 trillion war there. Give us a money analysis.
It starts in Congress, right? This, in the coming days or weeks, both houses will vote on the Defense Appropriations Act for 2012, which includes $119 billion for a couple of wars, mostly for Afghanistan. It goes from there to private contractors. The military has been privatized so that we have more private contractors under our employment in Afghanistan than U.S. troops. It is a hugely profitable enterprise. An executive from a weapons company told PBS some weeks back that if it is scaled back, he certainly hopes we will occupy Libya. Right? This is about making money for some people. And a huge amount goes to Karzai and his warlords and our friendly warlords, many of whom ship vast amounts out to the United Arab Emirates and elsewhere, many of whom are profiting dramatically, and as are many people in the pay of the occupation in Kabul. And many of those people require the protection of U.S. and Afghan soldiers, because the Afghan people are getting nothing out of this. They have not benefited, and will not benefit if this continues for years or decades to come.
We're speaking with David Swanson, the author of The War is a Lie, and I suspect that in that opus you go beyond the specifics of the case of Afghanistan. What do you cover in that?
I try to cover the history of warfare with a particular focus on U.S. wars and look at just about all of them, large and small, including Afghanistan, where, of course, the Taliban was willing to turn bin Laden over to a third country to be put on trial before or after 9/11, and our president was not interested in that, was more interested in a war. You then have, as is typical with wars, the initial justification get dropped and new justifications come along. As in Libya, it's not about a humanitarian rescue anymore. In Iraq, it's not about the weapons anymore. You come up with new reasons. And so in Afghanistan, it's about protecting us from the Taliban, which is blurred with Al-Qaeda and nation building and democracy and so forth. And once the war finally is over, it will be about something completely different to make it look better after the fact. And so what I do in the book, War is a Lie, is look at the common themes of lies that are used before, during, and after wars to argue that Iraq was not somehow unique, but all of our wars are based on lies.
Speaking of other wars, there is the other executive action taking place under the Obama administration, specifically in Libya. And there we're seeing, despite the front ending of it by NATO, but the coordination of it by Washington, the United States, the Pentagon, the Obama administration, the bombing of civilian areas, the attacks on the living quarters of a sitting head of state, Muammar Gaddafi, and so on. There has been either a constitutional challenge or a tempest in a teapot in Washington, D.C. with regard to that. There are lawsuits pending by members of the House of Representatives against what they say is a violation of the War Powers Act by Obama in launching hostilities. And then there is a reactionary or countervailing initiative by none other than Senator John Kerry teaming up with John McCain to give permission for the continuation of the military operation in Libya. As of this moment, a vote on the issue of funding the Libya operation is scheduled in Congress for tomorrow, Friday, the 24th of June, 2011. Have you also been following the war in Libya, and what is your assessment of that and where we stand with that today?
Yes, and I used to work for Congressman Kucinich, who is the lead plaintiff of these 10 Congress members, seven of them Republicans, who've sued the president in court, and who is the sponsor of the strongest resolution to actually cut off the money. And I am fully supportive. I think there is a very broad agreement that the Libya war is the most blatantly illegal, unconstitutional war the United States has ever had. It's not the worst in death count or any number of other measures, but it violates the Constitution and it violates the War Powers Act in a way that no serious war has since the War Powers Act was put in place in 1973. And not just because we are NATO and we fund NATO and most of the operations are funded by the United States while Europeans have education and health care and pensions instead, but because the Congress was not consulted. Now, the War Powers Act is only really applicable if the United States is attacked, and Libya did not attack us or anyone else or even threaten to. But if you pretend that the War Powers resolution is relevant, this president has intentionally violated it in every way possible, intentionally avoiding congressional authorization that he could have had, and now argues, not as John Yoo would have him argue, that presidents can simply do whatever they want and that law doesn't matter, but that the law doesn't apply because this is not hostilities. This is not a war, and it's not hostilities. Right? The authors of that bill in 1973 were very careful to encompass all military actions under the language of hostilities. This president says no. These are non-hostile bombings of neighborhoods.
Well, finally, David Swanson, for those who would seek to intervene to prevent an endless morass in Afghanistan, Libya, Pakistan, and other wars of opportunity, what would you suggest that people do? There's been a quietude about this from much of the peace movement. Aside from reading The War is a Lie, how do you see getting out of this?
Well, educate, organize, lobby, inform, take every step that is possible from your particular situation. But ultimately, we have to do what other nations do, what Tunisians do, what Egyptians do, what people in Madison, Wisconsin do, what people in Bloombergville do, and that is get in the way physically. Stop just, you know, getting arrested for show in front of the White House on a sidewalk where nobody actually has to walk to make the wars happen. So October 6th, when this war in Afghanistan hits 10 years, we are going to go in large numbers to Washington, D.C. and stay and build it and shut things down. And I encourage people to go to October2011.org and learn about it and pledge to be there. That's October2011.org.
And that is David Swanson, the author of The War is a Lie. And he has another publication called The War is a Crime and a very vivacious website at davidswanson.org. Thank you for joining us, David.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And even as we speak from the studios of WBAI in New York City, we are awaiting the arrival in the environs of our neighborhood, Wall Street, of President Barack Obama coming in to do some fundraising this evening in New York City after pumping up the troops at Fort Drum, the mountain brigade up in upstate New York. And it was just hours ago that President Obama addressed the nation on his plans for Afghanistan. Here's some of what he had to say.
By the time I took office, the war in Afghanistan had entered its seventh year. But Al-Qaeda's leaders had escaped into Pakistan and were plotting new attacks, while the Taliban had regrouped and gone on the offensive. Without a new strategy and decisive action, our military commanders warned that we could face a resurgent Al-Qaeda and a Taliban taking over large parts of Afghanistan. For this reason, in one of the most difficult decisions that I've made as president, I ordered an additional 30,000 American troops into Afghanistan. When I announced this surge at West Point, we set clear objectives: to refocus on Al-Qaeda, to reverse the Taliban's momentum, and train Afghan security forces to defend their own country. I also made it clear that our commitment would not be open-ended and that we would begin to draw down our forces this July. Tonight, I can tell you that we are fulfilling that commitment. Thanks to our extraordinary men and women in uniform, our civilian personnel, and our many coalition partners, we are meeting our goals. As a result, starting next month, we will be able to remove 10,000 of our troops from Afghanistan by the end of this year, and we will bring home a total of 33,000 troops by next summer, fully recovering the surge I announced at West Point. After this initial reduction, our troops will continue coming home at a steady pace as Afghan security forces move into the lead. Our mission will change from combat to support. By 2014, this process of transition will be complete, and the Afghan people will be responsible for their own security. We're starting this drawdown from a position of strength. Al-Qaeda is under more pressure than at any time since 9/11. Together with the Pakistanis, we have taken out more than half of Al-Qaeda's leadership. And thanks to our intelligence professionals and special forces, we killed Osama bin Laden, the only leader that Al-Qaeda had ever known. This was a victory for all who have served since 9/11. One soldier summed it up well. The message, he said, is we don't forget. You will be held accountable no matter how long it takes. The information that we recovered from bin Laden's compound shows Al-Qaeda under enormous strain. Bin Laden expressed concern that Al-Qaeda had been unable to effectively replace senior terrorists that had been killed. and that Al-Qaeda has failed in its effort to portray America as a nation at war with Islam, thereby draining more widespread support. Al-Qaeda remains dangerous, and we must be vigilant against attacks. But we have put Al-Qaeda on a path to defeat, and we will not relent until the job is done. In Afghanistan, we've inflicted serious losses on the Taliban and taken a number of its strongholds. Along with our surge, our allies also increased their commitments, which helped stabilize more of the country. Afghan security forces have grown by over 100,000 troops, and in some provinces and municipalities, we've already begun to transition responsibility for security to the Afghan people. In the face of violence and intimidation, Afghans are fighting and dying for their country, establishing local police forces, opening markets and schools, creating new opportunities for women and girls, and trying to turn the page on decades of war. Of course, huge challenges remain. This is the beginning, but not the end, of our effort to wind down this war. We'll have to do the hard work of keeping the gains that we've made while we draw down our forces and transition responsibility for security to the Afghan government. And next May, in Chicago, we will host a summit with our NATO allies and partners to shape the next phase of this transition. We do know that peace cannot come to a land that has known so much war without a political settlement. So as we strengthen the Afghan government and security forces, America will join initiatives that reconcile the Afghan people, including the Taliban. Our position on these talks is clear. They must be led by the Afghan government, and those who want to be a part of a peaceful Afghanistan must break from Al-Qaeda, abandon violence, and abide by the Afghan Constitution. But, in part because of our military effort, we have reason to believe that progress can be made. The goal that we seek is achievable and can be expressed simply. No safe haven from which Al-Qaeda or its affiliates can launch attacks against our homeland or our allies. We won't try to make Afghanistan a perfect place. We will not police its streets or patrol its mountains indefinitely. That is the responsibility of the Afghan government, which must step up its ability to protect its people and move from an economy shaped by war to one that can sustain a lasting peace. What we can do and will do is build a partnership with the Afghan people that endures, one that ensures that we will be able to continue targeting terrorists and supporting a sovereign Afghan government. Of course, our efforts must also address terrorist safe havens in Pakistan. No country is more endangered by the presence of violent extremists, which is why we will continue to press Pakistan to expand its participation in securing a more peaceful future for this war-torn region. We'll work with the Pakistani government to root out...
President Barack Obama, speaking overnight in an address to the nation, announcing his reduction of his expansion of the war in Afghanistan sometime in the near future. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And one of the other venues of war is, of course, in the Mideast, in the territories of Palestine. We witnessed recently a tremendously severe bombing of the city of Gaza. And even as we speak, human rights activists from around the world are convening upon that site in order to bring humanitarian aid and compassionate attention to the state of the people of Palestine, and in particular in Gaza. We have just now been able to make live contact with Robert Naiman, the policy director of Just Foreign Policy. We are now speaking with him live from Greece at the staging of the flotilla that is attempting to bring human rights to that region. Robert, are you indeed with us?
I'm with you.
Well, good sir, thank you for your courage and your availability speaking to us from the other side of the world. And why don't you tell us what the situation is with the Audacity of Hope, the ironically named ship that is preparing to set sail or may already be in progress. And what are your circumstances at this time?
Well, the American passengers on the Audacity of Hope are currently in Greece, hoping to set sail for Gaza sometime in the next week. The exact date is unknown at present, but that's the goal. There are, at last count, 10 boats in the international flotilla coming from different places in Europe. There's a Canadian boat, there's an Irish boat. Some of these countries have joint boats, but there are French and Belgians and Australians and Norway and Sweden. So it's a very international effort, reflecting the concern around the world about the situation in Gaza, the fact that the blockade has been allowed to go on for so long and that governments have failed to act. So civil society is acting. And we've seen in the last several years that since the blockade has been imposed on 1.5 million people in Gaza, the only thing that's really had an impact is the flotilla that took place last year. So the moral logic of organizing another flotilla is overwhelming. This is the only thing that seems to have worked to prick the conscience of the world.
What are the contents, other than your souls and goodwill, of this mission to Gaza?
Well, you talked about compassionate attention. In the case of the U.S. boat to Gaza, we're bringing letters written by thousands of Americans that the U.S. boat to Gaza has collected, letters from Americans to people in Gaza. And we're doing that for several reasons. One is that the thing that Gazans have been saying to activists that have visited Gaza that managed to get in the past few years is, you know, we don't really want aid. We are suffering here, but aid isn't our top priority. Our top priority is our freedom. So what we're looking for is solidarity and attention and bringing pressure against this blockade so we can take care of ourselves. You know, we have land. We have the ability to farm. We have the ability to fish. We have the ability to produce. We have the ability to work. If only these restrictions would be lifted on us. You know, now the Israeli government only allows Palestinian fishermen to go out 3 nautical miles, even though they were promised 20 under the Oslo Accord. So that section of the economy in Gaza has been devastated, tremendous increase in poverty among fishermen. Same thing among Palestinian farmers in Gaza, a third of the arable land now off limits. Gaza's not allowed to export to Europe or to the West Bank, even though they have, you know, they grow fruit there. But they can't export it because of Israeli restrictions. So we're really focusing on the demand for justice and calling attention to the blockade. Other boats in the flotilla are bringing humanitarian aid, which is needed. There's a tremendous crisis there, particularly now recently reported in the hospitals, running out of medicine. So it's not that they don't also have physical needs that need to be met. But our American boat in particular is you know, focusing on the justice issue, the fact that these people could much better take care of themselves if they were not being subjected to collective punishment by the governments of Israel and Egypt, supported by the United States.
Which brings us to another issue, the Egypt and Gaza crossing. There have been intimations and promises of an opening of that access to resources with the Palestinian territories. Is that in fact taking place? How does that figure in relief for the people of Gaza?
Well, something took place, but I'm afraid that what took place didn't match the hype. There's been a small increase in the number of people allowed through the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt. And that of course, is, you know, welcome. Any easing is welcome. But the flow of people is still much less, like half of what it was before the blockade was imposed. And in addition, it doesn't do anything about the flow of commerce, because the Egypt-Rafah crossing, Egypt-Gaza crossing, is a passenger crossing. It's not a cargo crossing. So it doesn't allow goods to go through in either direction, partly because of the physical limitations of the site, partly because of the policy of the Egyptian government, which is not to allow things to go through without the permission and approval of the Israeli government. So, unfortunately, Egypt is still largely collaborating with the blockade till now. We'll see what happens in the future.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. We are now speaking live with Robert Naiman, the Policy Director of Just Foreign Policy from the nation of Greece at this very moment. Where exactly are you, Robert?
I'm in Athens at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, in just a short time, a matter of tens of hours from now, the flotilla, including the American ship, Audacity of Hope, is going to brave the waters and other hazards in order to come to meet and serve the people of Gaza, Palestine, and by extension, I would imagine the West Bank, because of the affinity between those two separated territories that are presented to us as a nation. And I'd like to know, as you prepare to sail, Robert Naiman, what kind of obstacles do you expect to face, nautical, military, and diplomatic, whether from Israel or its number one supplier, the United States?
Well, I'm afraid that we face a lot of potential obstacles. First of all, of course, the thing that's most on people's minds is what happened last year. The Israeli authorities attacked the flotilla with lethal force. Nine human beings were killed, one of them an American. The others were Turkish citizens. Several dozen people were injured. So obviously that's something on many people's minds in terms of threat to life, the threat of attack by the Israeli authorities. The U.S. government, unfortunately, is not only supporting the blockade, but de facto supporting the Israeli government threats. The State Department put out yet another travel advisory yesterday, which, you know, warning Americans not to go to Gaza, and in particular not to go to Gaza by sea, obviously a reference to the flotilla. And we were very disappointed to see that. You know, we're American citizens. It's the job of the State Department. One of the jobs of the State Department is to act to protect American citizens when they travel abroad. And many people saw this statement interpreted as the U.S. government, you know, washing its hands like Pontius Pilate, saying, you know, well, this has nothing to do with us. These people are taking a risk. We told them not to, so whatever happens, you know, it's their own fault. They didn't exactly say that, but that's certainly how many people have interpreted their statement. And we think that's very disappointing because, you know, in other contexts, the U.S. government would at least be, you know, calling on all parties to exercise restraint. I mean, this is a case where the U.S. government has tremendous influence. It gives billions of dollars in military and economic aid to the government of Israel every year. It protects the government of Israel at the United Nations diplomatically by threatening to veto and often vetoing any efforts to constrain Israeli government violations of human rights. So the U.S. has tremendous influence, but it's not using that influence for good. It's using that influence to maintain the status quo. And there are efforts to pressure other governments. We haven't seen that all play out yet. It's not clear whether some obstacles may be thrown in our way in terms of leaving Greece. That remains to be seen. But we're hopeful that we will be allowed to leave, that we will be allowed to set sail and join the other boats. And we're hopeful that the Israeli government authorities will ultimately decide to turn away from violence. They paid a tremendous political price for their attack on the flotilla last year. It added greatly to the diplomatic isolation of the Israeli government. This is a time when they can scarcely afford it, with the Palestinians planning to go to the United Nations in September, asking for United Nations recognition of Palestinian statehood, at a time when people in Europe are really fed up with the status quo, looking for some movement. So I'm hopeful that that pressure will induce the Israeli government to show restraint, even though the U.S. government isn't pushing them to do that.
Well, Robert Naiman, It is very fortuitous that you were able to join us live here today on 5 o'clock Shadow. And I think on behalf of all of us here, we're wishing you and all of your scores of colleagues, of humanitarians, a ship of humanitarians, or ships, nearly a dozen of them heading for Gaza, we wish you safety and success.
We thank you for your good wishes.
We'll stay in touch. You will have air cover.
Thank you.
You will be on the air. Thank you, and all our best to all of your colleagues there. And we invite our listeners to keep abreast of this and related developments through such programs as Wake Up Call with Esther Arma, Hugh Hamilton's excellent talk back in the afternoons here at WBAI, Tahrir, our Mideast Affairs program here at WBAI, Gary Null, who covers international affairs from time to time, as well as the WBAI Evening News. And perhaps among them, 5 o'clock Shadow, which this is. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we come to the closing quadrant of today's program with reconnection to issues nuclear. We note that there are developments breaking rapidly in Nebraska. Here are some of the nuclear events that are taking place as we speak today. There is a new admission of water levels at one of the nuclear power plants. There are two nuclear power plants in Nebraska. The northernmost one is 20 miles north of Omaha. It is called the Fort Calhoun Nuclear Station. And the other one, which is near Brownville, Nebraska, is called the Cooper Nuclear Station. Both of them are threatened by the tremendously rising and raging waters of the Missouri River. The Missouri River is increasing in its height because of the accumulation of snow that is melting with this spring warmth and with unusually high rains and thunderstorms in the region. In addition to that, the Army Corps of Engineers is trying to regulate the dam structures upstream of these two plants because the water levels or the water volumes are so great that the dams could break or overflow or be otherwise put into mechanical hazard. So the Army Corps is releasing water into the Missouri River, which exacerbates the situation downstream. At the present time, Gavin's Point, since we last spoke of this, has increased the rate of flow from 150 to 160,000 cubic feet per second. That's more than a million gallons per second being released into the river. And flowing, flooding, surging downstream, sometimes spilling over broken levees, sometimes overflowing into farmland. And among the proximate victims or targets of this water flooding are these two nuclear power plants. The Cooper and the Calhoun stations, both in the past several days, on June 6th in the case of Fort Calhoun up north, and just over the weekend in the Cooper case, have declared what the NRC calls a notification of unusual event. It is the fourth lowest level of emergency as defined by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission of the United States, not to be confused with the International Atomic Energy Agency classifications of nuclear events. So this preliminary stage of emergency, called an unusual event, is in effect, meaning that they're sandbagging doors. They have placed portable berms around these plants. They call them aqua dams or aqua berms. And essentially what it is a great big bicycle inner tube filled with water to keep the other water out from inside the circumference of these artificial berms or artificial aqua dams. Their integrity is certain to be tested over the coming months. The Weather Service and the U.S. Geological Survey is predicting that the water levels will rise at least another 5 to 7 feet in the coming days and weeks, and that there will be flood conditions throughout the entire summer. Two of the latest discoveries for us today on this issue from the Nebraska Public Power District and the Omaha Public Power District, the respective operators of those two plants, is that there is 2 feet of water already on plant grounds, and there are five dozen employees at a times. 60 people or more are sleeping in portable beds at that nuclear power plant. They stay there for 2 days or so, then they get rotated out with other workers. There is a constant presence of a high number of plant workers at the Cooper Station further south. At Fort Calhoun to the north, perhaps even more alarming indication of the severity of the danger there. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission in recent weeks had two on-site inspectors at Fort Calhoun. Overnight, the NRC has now sent four more staff people from the NRC to supervise operations at Fort Calhoun. So there is some concern about what could happen there. Of course, water getting into the plant could mean the loss of external electricity, and the key thing being that takes out the power for the pumps that keep the reactor cores or the spent fuel pool areas cool. If that is not kept cool, we could end up with a situation like in Fukushima where there could be uncontrolled heating, hydrogen releases, and release of radioactive materials into a flooding, raging river. So that is the situation as far as we know at this time at Fort Calhoun and Cooper. Also this just in, the head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Mr. Yazko, is due to make a personal visit to the Nebraska nuclear power plants at an undetermined moment in the near future. And one of the things that is being done to help surround and protect these plants, if that is possible, is building sandbags. Ironically enough, there's not enough sand to make the sandbags for the rivers for the nuclear power plants in Nebraska because the Silty River, the Missouri River, is so flooded that it's no longer possible to navigate or scoop the sand to put in the bags to keep the river from overflowing its banks. The Weather Service and USGS indicators of water levels have broken down a time or two over the past few days, so sometimes those readings are unreliable. All of this comes as the Associated Press reports this week that 48 of 65 nuclear stations studied in the United States have been leaking tritium. That is a radioactive isotope that has been entering the environment. Corroded piping and ancient devices, nuclear power plants, is to blame for that. At 37 sites, contamination to groundwater exceeded the federal drinking water standard. Speaking of water, in Japan, Fukushima, the hapless Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, has now had yet another failure with their harebrained attempt to purify the radioactive water that has continued to leak into the water table and the Pacific Ocean. They imported a so-called filtration system, but it's filtering out so much radioactivity that it's too hot to go to the filtration machine because the filters are too radioactive. Cesium-137 is now being taken out of the system at only one-tenth of the promised rate, so that water remains dirty and hot. The International Atomic Energy Agency has complained that Japanese officials lied to them and kept critical information away from the IAEA and meteorological agencies in order to track and predict the distribution of the isotopes from that doomed nuclear complex. And meanwhile, in Japan, children are going to school with dosimeters with radiation badges in some areas. And the government has tried to raise the acceptable limit of exposure to children. But in the Chiba district, local authorities have actually said that they're going to insist that it be reduced because the playgrounds that the children go into have the isotopes that have been blowing in the wind to the schoolyards. And finally, five nuclear experts were killed in a plane crash in Russia earlier this week. And it now turns out that those five Russian nuclear experts and technologists had been working on the Bushehr atomic facility in Iran until they all died in a plane crash in Russia. That's some of the nuclear news today. And you've been listening to 5 O'Clock Shadow, and we give great thanks today for production of today's program to Michael G. Haskins, our engineer, and Thiago Brauzo, who has done yeoman's duty in today's production of a rapidly breaking, developing program. Stay tuned for another Frackin' Monday on Monday in this time period, and then on Tuesday, a very special program when we return with Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates with the latest, greatest details on the nuclear scene. 4 or 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Thank you for listening.
Oh, a storm is threatening my very life today. If I don't get some shelter, oh yes, I'm gonna fade away.
Oh, yeah, I'm gonna fade away. Whoa.